Out in the Bay is proudly supported by Comcast, celebrating Pride with TV, movies, and more in 2020. Xfinity is curated an LGBTQ film and TV destination on its X1, Flex, and Stream platforms that celebrates the community all year long. Just say Pride into your Xfinity voice remote.
Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. Today, in the wake of George Floyd's killing in Minneapolis last month, we're discussing the queer community's response to anti-Black violence and systemic racism. A little aside, for those of you unfamiliar with our program, Out in the Bay aired on KALW here in San Francisco for 11 years until 2016, when I had to put it aside to help care for my mom in her final years. We started our relaunch plans late last year. We're very thankful to KSFP, our new broadcast home, for giving us airtime. We certainly didn't plan to relaunch Out in the Bay in the midst of a global pandemic, nor as justifiably angry protests over police violence have raged around us. But here we are, back on the air in these challenging times and continuing with our mission to advance civil rights by sharing queer voices with the world. The recent murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery have resulted in outrage across the U.S. and abroad over systemic racism and injustice the Black community continues to endure. Shortly after Floyd's killing, Tony McDade, a Black transgender man, was killed by police in Tallahassee, Florida. His death has not received the same national media attention, and there have been many, many other killings. Because the recent protests peaked just about when Pride Month began, many of us are reminded that Pride parades started to commemorate the Stonewall riots in New York in June 1969. That was led by Black and brown transgender women who were fed up with police mistreatment then. Many credit that with sparking the modern LGBTQ liberation movement, but of course here in the Bay Area, many would argue that the movement had its roots in the Tenderloin Zone Compton's Cafeteria riot in 1966. The recent deaths have forced us to confront the legacy of racism and anti-Blackness, perhaps we'll talk about that term, within the queer community. And while Black Americans face significant prejudice in this country, Black, queer, and trans people experience not only racism, but also homophobia, transphobia, and misogyny. In this half hour, we'll address how these deaths have affected the LGBTQ community, especially the Black, trans, and queer community. How can our community provide meaningful support to Black people? And what hopeful effects are protests around the country and the world having? Here to unpack these complex issues are Bay Area and national queer leaders in the fight against discrimination. Earl Folks Jr. is the president and CEO of the Center for Black Equity, a Washington, D.C.-based organization connecting the Black LGBT community with information and resources to help achieve health, economic, and social equity. Welcome, Earl.
Thank you.
Taquan Harrison, LGBTQI Policy and Program Officer at the San Francisco Human Rights Commission. Welcome, Taquan.
Thank you for having me.
And Janelle Luster, Program Associate at the Transgender District in San Francisco. Welcome, Janelle.
Hey, thank you.
So thank you all for being here. Before we get to rolling, I want to know, how are you all doing at this moment? It's quite a time we're living through.
Drained emotionally and mentally. It's a lot going on, so I would say drained and, yeah.
Yeah, I would say that it's been, honestly speaking, very challenging, just specifically around, like, mental health with social media and, you know, the sharing of, you know, the violence that we're seeing on the internet in regards to, like, the death and the killing of Black bodies sanctioned by the state, by police. You know, so I think that it's been really, you know, hard to be engaged when you want to see, like, you know, what's going on within the media, but also having to, like, take some steps back into take your own self-care and your own self-preservation as a Black person.
Yeah, absolutely. Earl?
You know, between COVID-19 and the George Floyd situation, is this layer after layer of emotional feelings and this social distancing and isolation and quarantine. It's been a lot. So what I've done is recently I went to a friend's house who lives, I live in DC and it's been all the riots here. And just before the riots started and the demonstration started, I went to New Jersey, North Jersey, in the suburbs, away from everything with a swimming pool and doing my work by the swimming pool and having a adult beverage and just, and turning off the news for basically 10 days. And I felt that when I came back to D.C. to come back and into the middle of things, that it was much more relaxed and much more spiritually grounded.
That's fantastic to be able to take 10 days off. So people all over the world have taken to the streets to protest recent police murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery. Well, this recent murder of a trans man, Tony McDade, and the beating of a trans woman, Ayanna Deore, in Minneapolis have received a lot less attention nationally. So to Quan, perhaps, have these horrid events received the attention they deserve within the Black community and within the queer community?
I think that... when having this conversation, an important thing to frame is around like intersectionality of what it means to be a Black person and what it means to be a queer person and existing within, you know, these multifaceted, like, you know, and identity environments. I think that in particular with the Black community, that there hasn't been enough light shed on Black trans and queer folks who have been, you know, have experienced violence within like the larger, like the state. So I think that there has been like a poor coverage, but I think that also just kind of like to make things a little bit more complicated. Breonna Taylor also didn't receive as much coverage as well, in the media too, as well. So is it something around like, you know, cissexism, you know, sexism where, you know, Black men are, you know, given like a more privileged, kind of like platform when having these kind of like global conversations around like anti-Blackness. And I think that we do need to do a better job at being inclusive of our trans sisters and brothers when doing this work and advocacy. And I think that the LGBTQ community also has similar issues around anti-Black sentiments. And a lot of my work in San Francisco has been around advancing equity and talking about anti-Blackness within the larger LGBTQ space. Because I feel like a lot of times Black trans projects are not funded. Folks are not working with these projects and these folks in the community. So I think that being Black and queer sometimes feels like, you know, you're holding two worlds and trying to, you know, fight for inclusion for yourselves, but there's been a lot of solidarity and community building amongst Black, queer, trans leaders within the Bay Area and throughout the nation. So I'm hopeful.
Thank you. I do want to get back to that, what you just mentioned about anti-Black sentiment within the queer community. Janelle, when you spoke with my producer, Kendra Klang, I think you told her about posting something on social media about Tony McDade's murder, and you received some responses. What kind of responses did you receive from that?
There was a lot of mixed responses. I have a lot of LGBT people, and so people resharing it and making sure that the story got out there. And then there were there was this incident where one of my cis Black friends on Facebook was talking about the march that we had organized. Well, Black trans men organized the march in Oakland, which happened last weekend. And I had shared the post, and she was basically just talking about, hey, there's a protest happening in Oakland tomorrow, but she didn't understand how Tony McDade's death was similar to George Floyd's death. And she questioned why everything that happened to Tony McDade happened. And I was just scrolling Facebook the next day, just like Taquan was speaking about all this stuff on media. So just seeing it, and I stopped and... It really offended me initially because I'm like, hey, I wonder if I'm that person that shared that post and she's talking about my post. And so I was commenting under and I'm like, hey, well, first off, I think that you could have reached out to me personally and asked me how the cases were the same. And then I just went on to tell her how I thought that her post was very disrespectful and insensitive, and that Tony McDade was another Black man who was killed by the police. And when we talk about George Floyd's death, I know so many people didn't even know why he was being arrested or detained. All we know is that there was this video that surfaced and we see him on the ground. To me, it didn't seem like he even had a chance to resist anything with this officer's knee on his neck. And we did not question why or what he had done to get there. We just knew that what was happening to him was not justice. And so I didn't understand how this friend of on my Facebook platform didn't get that. And so as I was trying to educate her about how the two were the same and how you know, this post is what is divisive for our community, and that was not something that needed to be posted. She felt attacked. I had screenshotted her post because lots of time when you, you know, try to correct that type of, those type of things, people feel attacked and they take the post down and they try to retract everything that they say. And so my idea with screenshotting it and posting it on my Facebook was like, hey, other folks should help me, in educating her, because as a Black trans woman, I know that just seeing this, I can really come from a place of hurt and anger. And sometimes it could be hard to like get my point across. But she felt attacked and unfriended me.
I'm curious also, our producer mentioned that you have been fearful of going to some of the protests as a trans woman. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Fearful. I mean, I don't want to really like just put out there that it's the fearful part. It's the more so like the principle of the fact that I can be at these protests and these are the same people who would, you know, record me getting attacked in that same, in these same areas. Like, I'm from Oakland. And so with the Black Lives Matter movement, there are, I don't always feel included. And so when I think about the Black Lives Matter movement, and I know that, you know, we're always championing for Black men to not get killed by police, because that's what's happening. And I do stand in solidarity, and I don't believe that that should happen. But going to the protests, for me, I'm like, when Black trans women are killed, none of these people are there. None of these people are, you know, saying our names. But yet, you know, Black queer people or queer people in general, we're always there. We're always on the front lines, advocating and protesting with our cis het counterparts, but they don't do the same for us. And so I don't want to put out there that I'm fearful of going as if something is going to happen to me. I just don't feel like they would do the same in return for me. And so I stand in solidarity from my couch. Yeah.
Earl, I wonder if you can give us a sort of a national perspective since you're in D.C. First of all, tell us a little bit about the origins of the Center for Racial Equity that you...
Well, actually, the organization is called the Center for Black Equity.
Oh, I'm sorry. Center for Black Equity.
It started in 1999 when eight Black prides, Black queer prides, formed a federation. It was called the International Federation of Black Prides. And so the eight prides in L.A., Detroit, Chicago, North Carolina, New York, D.C., Jacksonville, and Philadelphia... And we met in D.C. in 1999, and we wrote our kind of mission. We continue to grow. Over the last 21 years, we have now 47 U.S. affiliates, U.S. Black Prides, and 10 abroad, and including in Europe and in Africa and South America. And the purpose of the Center for Black Equity, as we are known now, is to really form an umbrella organization to train our 47 Pride leaders who are community activists, many of them are community activists, to train them on how to deal with issues such as what's happened, what Janelle is explaining, you know, our place in the movement of various movements that are taking place. There's a queer movement, there's a Black movement, there's a brown movement. What's our place in it, and how do we advocate with our allies and those people who are not our allies for the services we need in our communities?
Thank you. Where do we go from here? There have been so many statements of solidarity with the Black community in all kinds of places. I live in a pretty white neighborhood in Berkeley, okay? And I would say that a few years ago, you started to see Black Lives Matter signs popping up more and more, a little bit here and there. But in the last, you know, few weeks, it's everywhere, and there are homemade signs. And there are flyers to take to get involved. And I think a lot of white people are frankly wringing their hands and saying, like, what can we do? And there's also you're seeing a lot of white people in the marches and demonstrations that perhaps hadn't been seen in earlier demonstrations. What kind of hope do you have? What kind of change do you see happening? How can we harness this this energy? Whoever wants to jump in and answer that. Earl, please go ahead. Earl Folks.
You know, this is a good question. I'm asked this question a lot in the last 2 weeks. You know, what can my white allies and my white friends, what can we do? This is horrible. This shouldn't happen in our country. And part of me is very hopeful because there are different people who are stepping beyond their comfort zone to confront an issue that, to be quite frankly, is not a Black issue. This is a white issue. We didn't cause racism. So that's not my obligation to resolve it. You know, my obligation is to try to live within the racist apartheid society that we have and survive, and to end up being an old man. That's what I'm surviving, trying to do now. So the reality is that this issue is a white issue, and white people should step out because they're the ones who are doing it. And even if they're quietly complicit, they're still contributing towards racism. Now, I wrote an op-ed that appeared in the D.C. Queer magazine that went viral, basically looking at racism and condemning our racist and calling out our racist government, our racist society that we've been living in for 101 years. I've gotten such visceral responses and such hate-filled, and it doesn't bother me. I don't feel in danger. But the fact of the matter is that on one hand, you have people standing in solidarity with us. And on the other hand, we have white folks who are just as racist and believe the Confederacy should have won the Civil War and still are acting like we're fighting the Civil War. And those are the people we have to move, not the people who are willing to join us, but the people who are actually holding this racist system together.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's been a lot of great solidarity around like funding Black-led LGBTQ organization that a lot of people are putting their money where their mouths are, like literally, and supporting Black leadership, supporting Black determination. We can make the decisions for ourselves. We know what we need in our communities. We know what resources that we want to allocate to our most vulnerable and our most marginalized folks who are Black, trans folks and queer folks and LGBTQ folks. So I think that there needs to be a lot more, funding going to those organizations. Cause I know like trans-led projects in general, I think they only receive like 1% of funding from larger LGBTQ mm-hmm. kind of like foundations. I'm sure like now that we have like a lot more Black-led organizations currently within San Francisco Bay Area and throughout the nation, throughout the country, that they're receiving maybe a small fraction of that. So I think that there needs to be a lot more funding and a lot more resourcing to our leaders and community.
And I want to just add, it's more than just giving donations. It's about an intentional redistribution of resources. Mm. And this is not talking about feel-good donations. You give a couple thousand dollars to put a Band-Aid over a gaping wound. We're talking about the systematic transfer of funding from the government and from private foundations and private individuals over a long period of time, as long as it takes, 15, 20, 30, 40 years. That's what has to happen.
Yes.
Thank you.
Totally agree. Thank you, Earl.
I agree, yes.
What do you think about the movements for police reform? San Francisco Mayor London Breed recently announced that she's going to make some big changes in how San Francisco policing is done. Minneapolis is talking about actually defunding the police almost entirely. Oakland Public Schools have said they're going to get rid of the Oakland School District Police. It hasn't happened yet, but there's talk. How important do you see these things? Or is this just one piece of this huge puzzle? I'm sorry, Janelle, you go ahead.
Yeah, I definitely think that is one piece of the puzzle. The police definitely historically just have like bad representation with community. I definitely feel like there is a need for police for what they were hired to do. But the excessive force that they are using and all of these videos and stuff that are coming out just really shows. And I think that defund the police is like great, but I think it definitely needs to be changed in the way that they are handling people. I think that kind of stuff needs to change.
And what is the relationship in your experience been with police and the trans community specifically in San Francisco?
It's horrible. Police harass trans people, trans women specifically engaging in sex work and the tenderloins. The police presence is so high. Also with trans women being homeless. And so I know at one time when that was me, like just being harassed by the police, asking me if I'm doing sex work, when that may not have been what I was engaging in. I definitely was engaging in other things, but just being targeted and harassed in that way, I think that we prefer not to deal with the police at all. And so there's even this thing that when we're attacked, we're not calling the police because we don't feel like the police are on our side either. There has been times when I have called the police because things have happened to me and they do like everyone else do and question, well, what did you do? And not even really even take a police report. And it's like they're sitting here just throwing all these words out and then they leave and I'm still out there like defenseless. So I don't have a really good relationship with them. And I know a lot of my sisters don't either.
Earl Folks Jr., what's it like nationally?
It seems to me that if you're going to truly reform the police, which everyone agrees they need to be reformed, we need to stop having them look like paramilitary invaders. So when something happens in the community, they come into with these tanks and multi-round weapons and fatigues, and they look like an occupying force. And I think if you're going to rebuild the police department, how effective is the new police department going to be if you're using the same people who are doing things in the old police department? Mm-hmm. So we need to return to a concept of doing several things. First of all, we need to return to a concept of community policing, where people who are living in the community are police officers, and they live in the community, they're part of the community, and they participate in community. And the second thing is that you have to address the issues why we have crime. And you know, when no one's talking about that, it's not just reforming the police are often reacting to circumstances based on poverty and economics. We need to improve the opportunities for young people, especially people of color, and especially our trans sisters, siblings, so they have opportunity to. No one wants to be a deadbeat. We want to work. People want jobs. They want education. They want opportunities. That's all we're asking, is for the same opportunities everyone else is receiving.
You're listening to Out in the Bay on KSFP. I'm Eric Jansen. My guests today are Earl Folks Jr., President and CEO of the Center for Black Equity, Taquan Harrison, LGBTQI Policy and Program Officer at the San Francisco Human Rights Commission, and Janelle Luster, Program Associate at the Transgender District. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Out in the Bay is proudly supported by Comcast, celebrating pride with TV, movies, and more in 2020. Xfinity is curated an LGBTQ film and TV destination on its X1, Flex, and Stream platforms that celebrates the community all year long. Just say Pride into your Xfinity voice remote to get started.
We're discussing the LGBTQ community's response to the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Tony McDade. So where do we go from here? What do we need to do as individuals and as community?
Hi, this is Taquan again. We've been hosting a lot of community roundtable conversations with folks in community, specifically Black folks, around organizing. What does it mean for us as a Black community to, you know, address these larger systemic issues that we're seeing, particularly around like police violence and policing? And how are we being inclusive of our trans and queer folks who are in leadership within the city to build that collaboration? So there's been a lot of community roundtable conversations and discussions. We're in the process of launching our San Francisco Black initiative, which is called Mega Black, to talk about policy platforms and discussions to address police violence and anti-Blackness within San Francisco. I think that there needs to be a lot more education and dialogue and discourse around what it means, anti-Blackness in the larger LGBTQ community. And then also, like Earl and I had said earlier, just around like funding these projects that are Black-led specifically for long periods of time.
Excuse my ignorance. I just heard the term anti-Blackness for the first time yesterday. Is it fairly new? And what does it mean specifically? Is it just, go ahead.
It's not fairly new. I think that it's been around for a long time. I think that folks maybe in more of like the academic or political sphere have, you know, used that terminology and word, but it's been around for a really long time. But anti-Blackness is specifically talking about, you know, the global system of anti-Black racism that Black folks throughout the world experience and face. And I think that as a people, it's important to have a more nuanced conversation on how things like colonization and white supremacy have impacted, you know, historically, you know, Black folks, Black American folks. Like, you know, our stories around racism and how we experience racism is very specific, and it's tied to a specific history, and it, you know, lives and breathes and manifests in a particular way that disproportionately impacts us as Black people.
Mm-hmm. Janelle, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what is going on in the Tenderloin, the transgender district specifically, and how we can make change, positive change there.
I think one of the things to like remember is that we're still living through a pandemic. COVID-19 is something that is still very real, and all of the things that are happening, I think, is like derailing us from like all of the stuff that is going on. The Tenderloin has so much poverty and homelessness. My job is there. I was just there yesterday and driving up and down the street and still seeing tents side by side and folks not wearing masks and things like that. And I think that We are going through this like crazy political climate, but I don't want us to forget about that. And I love that they were talking about funding these projects. I think we need to continuously try to help LGBT queer people get housed and off of the streets, and giving them more opportunities to get jobs and those workforce development trainings, I think would be great.
You mentioned the political context. Do you see any hope in the news that voter registration drives are doing well, having some progress, because people are fed up and realizing that perhaps, or maybe in the past they've thought my vote doesn't count, but now they're thinking, well, maybe it does count. What's your opinions on that?
I'm going to speak with two hats right this now. I'm the chair of the DNC LGBT caucus, and I'm just afraid that this will be, you know, something else will happen this year, which will take everyone's attention away from voting and from and electing people who have our best interests at heart. Our country is so easily distracted. Look how quickly COVID-19 was brushed off the front pages of our newspapers. You hardly hear about it. We're still in the bed, and many states are doing horrible around testing people and caring for people with COVID-19, yet we're not talking about it. And I'm afraid that something's going to happen in a couple of months. It's going to push the election, the importance of this election, off the front pages and push the conversation we're having now off the radio and off the media and off the tongues of people who need to be talking about this. And I wanted to say the racism that exists in the queer white community, for a black queer man, I have to deal with racism as a black man and racism as a queer man. And that's absurd. That the gay community should be welcoming to all types of people, not discriminate against our own people. Thank God that COVID-19 came along, because my fear was that George Floyd would have gotten killed and we would still have gay pride parades this month. And with the investment in this gay pride parades, but the millions of dollars in corporations, the organizers of these parades would not be willing to shut down these parades because of what's going on in Minneapolis. And that would have been a horror show for all of us.
I do think it's true that because George Floyd's killing was during the pandemic, when everybody's sitting at home, like stressed out and wondering what the heck's going on in the world, then this happens, and this video with this shocking, disgusting murder is out there for people to see. I think it is one of the reasons that this has become such a big deal and a turning point. And I hope it's not wasted. That's my personal feeling. Thank you all so much. I really appreciate your time. My guests today have been Earl Foulkes Jr., President and CEO of the Center for Black Equity, Taquan Harrison, LGBTQI+ Policy and Program Officer at the San Francisco Human Rights Commission, and Janelle Luster, Program Associate at the Transgender District. Thank you all for joining me. This conversation was recorded on Friday, June 12th, 2020. For more information about the organizations mentioned in today's broadcast and how to get involved, please see our website, outinthebay.org, where you can also find the audio for this program and past shows. Out in the Bay is available for download on popular podcast platforms. Have a question, comment, or suggestion? What do you want to hear? Reach us on Facebook at Out in the Bay, and at Twitter and Instagram at OutInTheBaySF. Today's show was produced by Kendra Klang. Huge thanks to you, Kendra. Big thanks also to KSFP for bringing Out in the Bay back on the air, and to Comcast for providing crucial funds to get us back up and running. Please join us next week for a discussion about San Francisco's 50th Pride celebration with SF Pride President Carolyn Wissinger. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for listening. Thank you.